Ao rea oco e coca aha, inahe kuliana imua okea aha, ho o kolo kolo ki ike hanahano o komoku ana o Hawaii. I nai mai, i malio mai, i lohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 18940, State of Hawaii versus Onhei. Arguing for the petitioner, Dana S. Ishibashi. Arguing for the respondent, Chad M. Kumagai, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning and aloha, everyone. This proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. I'd like to thank Judge To'oto'o for sitting with the court today. During the proceeding, should a justice have a question, they will raise their hands virtually today, and I will call upon them at the earliest opportunity. I'd like to start by asking our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing.
I'm Dana Ishibashi, attorney for the petitioner.
Thank you, Mr. Ishibashi.
Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Chad Kumagai for Respondent Appellee, State of Hawaii.
All right, thanks to both of you. Just to confirm, Mr. Ishibashi, you'll have 25 minutes with 5 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Mr. Kumagai, you'll have 30 minutes with a 5 minute warning, and you'll see a light and hear a tone at the end of your allotted time. Mr. Ishibashi, please proceed with your argument.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice and Associate Justices. This case, basically two issues. One is the issue of the lesser included offense of reckless endangering in the second degree. And the second issue basically dealing with whether the procedure in determining death is included in the cause of death element of murder or any other statute involving death such as manslaughter. First, like to make a comment on the lesser included. I was, studying various opinions, and I looked at State versus Manuel. And what occurred to me while I was looking at these that opinion, and as well as the practice in court, is that when a lesser included instruction is given, it's in a murder case, it starts at the top at murder, and then it goes to manslaughter, and then assault one and assault two, and et cetera, down the pecking order. But when I thought about that, and it sort of occurred to me that, one, there's different state of minds involved in manslaughter. So when the jury is instructed, they perhaps might be instructed in two veins, one in the vein of a reckless state of mind and one in the vein of intentional and knowing. Because, to jump from manslaughter back to an intentional state of mind might cause some problems. But I just made that observation while I was preparing for this case. But, I think I read the case manual, and I think it was well written. I think this case falls within it. So I'm not going to argue too much on that. I think pretty much this court should uphold that decision and declare, as it has in the past, that in fact reckless endangering in the second is a lesser included offense. Now, the ICA basically said,
Mr. Ishibashi, could you address the state's argument that this case might be distinguishable on the grounds that Mr. Onhei of testified he wasn't even at the scene at the time of the event, and so the evidence wouldn't support giving the instruction? Is that a distinction you think is relevant?
No, I don't, because there's other evidence involved in the case where people identified him, pointed him out in a lineup, and basically put him on the spot in front of the 7-Eleven out there in Waipahu. So, you know, I mean, he might have got up there and said that he wasn't there, but, you know, the evidence as it came out definitely showed that he was there. The preponderance of it, I would think, beyond a reasonable doubt. But anyway, what's happening in terms of the Court of Appeals opinion is they're looking at the result of the sitting down of the jury and finding that it was manslaughter, and so therefore didn't get to the assault, or assault in the first or assault in the second or third, and so therefore reckless endangering doesn't have a factual basis for it. But I disagree with that. I think when you look at the facts and the evidence in this case, my client was asking to buy weed from these guys. The guys got upset. They had been drinking previously, the two men, and they got up and they started hitting my client. One of the victims, or the friend of the decedent testified that his friend basically punched my client at least 10 times before that knife came out. Now, yes, the knife coming out, I mean, you can look at it both ways, and we tried to do the self-defense, but they didn't buy that. So obviously they went with reckless that bringing out this dangerous instrument, which resulted in this individual dying. So, I think there is a factual basis in this case for a lesser included offense of manslaughter, at least. And I think attached to that is the reckless, basically the reckless engaging in conduct, placing another in danger of death. And when that happens, I think it basically fits the description of reckless endangering in the second degree.
Mr. Ishibashi, could you turn to the next issue and address the question of whether there was a failure of proof as to whether there had been, your client had caused the death of the decedent in this case?
Exactly. You know, the statute 327C1 basically lays out how death is looked upon by the state, by the legislature. And there's that statute, which basically says when a person dies, and in this case, the person died after receiving care, after being hooked up to a life support system. And so what needed to happen was two doctors basically, and I laid it out in the type of doctors they are, physicians and osteopaths who are licensed, or even an RN who's licensed, but they must coincide with their thought of the cause of death. It's either cardiac arrest if the person died without going into
we have a question from Justice Wilson. Do you want to finish that thought?
The artificial means of he was giving his organs to organ donation, and then that under that circumstance, when a person dies, that the doctors must coincide with the declaration in writing before they go in and take the organs out, and they must determine that the person is brain dead, in order to do that in accordance with the law. Now, you might ask,
Mr. Ishibashi, could you just let's hear Justice Wilson's question?
Okay.
Oh, you're muted, Justice Wilson.
There we go. I'll unmute. Mr. Ishibashi, I am interested in your explanation about how the determination of death was made, but I wanted to ask your help in understanding the analysis of the ICA that seemed to be that this statute, Act 320C, 327C, doesn't apply. Now, the language of the statute itself, Section D, seems to say that it applies to civil and criminal actions. And the material that was reviewed by the legislature in reaching its determination included a rather extensive report called Towards a Definition of Death. It was prepared by the Legislative Research Bureau, and it goes into great detail about the issue of death in homicide cases. Five different cases are discussed that are criminal cases dealing with whether the definition of death should be based on brain death or not. It talks about the placement of the statute, where it should go, whether it should go into the section of the statutes that pertain to the criminal law. It also directly addresses the penal code and points out that the penal code at that point didn't have a definition of death. So I'm interested in your thoughts about how, if I'm correct, the ICA could conclude that 327C doesn't apply. It might have to do with the fact that it doesn't have specific sanctions. That was mentioned, but I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Right. Thank you for your question. This is a very important question, too. When you look at a charge of murder in the second degree in this case, You one of the main elements of that charge is cause of death. That is front and center in terms of what the state has to look towards in order to prove that this guy was murdered, or was he subject to manslaughter or anything else. It has to do with death, and that death is an element of the offense, and what the ICA is saying is basically we should ignore that element in the murder charge, basically because there's no consequence in that statute. Well, the consequence is in the penal code, that's where that consequence is. It's basically an element of the offense of murder. So that would be my response to that question.
Ishibashi, you have a follow-up question from Justice McKenna and then Justice Nakayama.
Thank you. Mr. Ishibashi, based on what Justice Wilson asked and the language of 327C1, D, which says this statute applies to all purposes, including criminal actions. How do you respond to the state's argument that if you have to prove death pursuant to 327C1 in all criminal prosecutions, what happens when a person is charged with murder and the body can't be found?
I have no idea what will happen under that circumstance, because I would expect, I mean, it's happened before, right? But I don't know the facts in that case, but I do understand that it's happened before where a person was charged with murder, but there was no body. So they didn't actually prove there was like a death. So, I don't know. I don't know how to deal with that. It's a complex problem. But the statute you know, it says, but not limited to, you know, civil and criminal actions, any laws to the contrary, notwithstanding. So, you know, I mean, when they say that, and then in the murder statute, you look at that and they have an exception. Basically, they are saying in the murder, you know, if you take in your own life and you signed up for that option, that you cannot be charged with murder. And so they made a specific exception to the rule that contained in the murder statute and the manslaughter statute. So, you know, it's pretty clear that something, and that's why we're here, we brought this issue to the court. And basically, yeah, dead is dead. But, you know, the way they wrote it is that's the way we're following the law. You know,
Mr. Ishibashi, we have a follow-up from Justice Nakayama and then another from Justice Wilson.
Mr. Ishibashi, looking at the stipulation that was introduced into evidence regarding Dr. Chang's pronouncement, number two says that Dr. Chang made a brain death pronouncement for Mr. Kanui Flores at 8:15 on January 29, 2018. Now, I know that in your briefs and in your oral argument, you have indicated you think 327C-1B applies. Is that correct? In your argument that two doctors need to make a pronouncement.
Yes.
Okay. The but first part
on,
of...
It depends on how the person... dies as well, right? Because if they go by cardiac arrest or something like that, then it's, you know, it's cardiac arrest. But if they are hooked up to a, you know, machine to help them breathe for the purpose of taking organs, then it's the option where they have to prove brain dead, yeah, brain stem cell death by at that stage.
So, okay, let me ask you about Section B. The first part of the statute says, in the event that artificial means of support preclude a determination that respiratory and circulatory functions have ceased. In this particular case, despite any type of rest, I assume he was on a respirator, Dr. Chang did pronounce him dead. So the fact that he was on the respirator didn't preclude a pronouncement of brain death. So why does the statute apply then?
Well, you know, there's two different opinions of how this person died. The statute calls for two opinions in writing to coincide.
It only needs two opinions if the means of support precludes an announcement of death. But it didn't. It didn't preclude because Dr. Chang declared him brain dead.
Well, I think it's either way that a person dies, whether it's by cardiac arrest or it's by, you know, being hooked up to a ventilator or something like that and then expires. In both instances, the way I read the statute is they have to coincide with the cause of death. I mean, you know, they're charging a guy with murder, and that's an element of the offense, is cause of death. So I would think that the, you know, the way the statute is written, it's pretty clear. You need two opinions, and they must coincide.
But Mr. Ishibashi, it's two opinions. If in the event that artificial means of support preclude a determination, the respiratory and circulatory functions have ceased. Is that the record we have here when Dr. Chang made her call?
Well, you know, they didn't want to come into court. And so the prosecutor drafted that stipulation, which basically I agreed to. You know, in terms of the cause of death. So that's what we got. We don't have any other evidence except there's anecdotal evidence by Series Kawhi, one of the the decedent's friend, who said he talked to the family and the family was going to pull the plug. I mean, and that's basically the evidence that we have. And that, and we also know from that stipulation is that there was organ donation as well. So, you know, I think that, you know, and it's however you choose to interpret that statute, but I believe the two opinions of the doctors must coincide. And I don't see why they can't just sit down and discuss these matters when a person is going to be charged with murder to coincide their opinions of how this person died.
All right. Wait, let's have Justice Wilson has been waiting patiently for a bit. Let's hear his question. Oh, you're muted, Justice Wilson. You got it? There you go.
Yeah. Thank you, CJ. Mr. Ishibashi, there has been some discussions about the declaration of brain death. And I wanted to get your understanding of what's required to make a determination of brain death with respect to proof and establishing that cause of death. In other words, you know, the Legislative Reference Bureau report I referred to noted that there are 9 different versions of the concept of brain function death. And then as a consequence, the language was placed in 327C1 that defines brain death. Now, this definition includes conditions such as that entire brain no longer have a function, that there be a cessation of all function to the entire brain, including the brain stem. Now, this is something that I guess arises from this careful consideration the legislature gave before it created the statute. And the idea of it being irreversible and also that the function of the brain stem be addressed, I wanted to ask you, do you think it's enough for the doctor to say that the brain is dead without addressing that aspect of the definition of brain death?
Well, the way I read the statute, and that's the only way I can argue this basically, is I believe the statute promotes the idea that when a person experiences irreversible cessation of spontaneous respiratory and circulatory functions, that's when death would have occurred. In the alternative, if artificial means of support precludes that kind of determination, and you know, how a person can say, on the one hand, you know, it's irreversible cessation of respiratory, spontaneous respiratory and circulatory functions, and at the same time be hooked up to, you know, artificial means of support. I mean, his body is still going. So it's either one or the other, you know? So, I mean, my thinking is that the statute is designed that way, that these two doctors or the nurse or whatever have to sit down and get together and talk about it and document it, put it in writing, and give it to us. You know, what is it? I mean, what's so hard about that?
Mr. Ishibashi, we have a question from Justice McKenna.
Thank you. So Dr. Chang's stipulated testimony was that the decedent was brain deaf. And did Dr. Happy also repeat that testimony?
Yes, basically that he talked about the organ donation, and because when he inspected the body and did the autopsy, some organs were not there. So
Dr. Happy also testify to brain death?
No. He just talked about the autopsy and what he saw.
Okay.
Didn't he testify the cause of death? And wasn't his testimony that the cause of death was
homicide?
Why? And how did he define? Did he define death?
He didn't define it in accordance with the statute. That's what I know. I think he just said the guy is dead, and it was a result of homicide.
All right. Isn't the standard definition of brain death that the brain stem is also not functioning?
Right. It's inclusive.
So you are conceding that perhaps Dr. Chang's testimony met the definition, because without the brainstem, respiratory and circulatory functions cannot continue, correct?
Right. But my position is that you can't die one way and then say that you died another way. You died one way.
Okay. Well, my question is, we have perhaps one doctor who testified as to brain death, which includes perhaps, at least in terms of sufficiency, there's a question perhaps as to whether or not it's sufficient to establish the brainstem, the lack of brainstem function, which my understanding is that, you know, if your brainstem is still functioning, you can still have respiratory function.
Right.
But without the brainstem, that doesn't happen. So therefore, if brain death includes brainstem death, then we might have Dr. Chang's testimony. But then my question is, the statute does require two doctors, another consulting physician. And I'm not sure whether there was another consulting physician or any other physician's testimony that would satisfy the consulting aspect of 327C-B, C-1B.
Well, the state used two physicians in their in the stipulation, basically, to overcome the cause of death issue. So I think that's where you have to look at. They chose that path. That's...
Who was the second physician?
Let's see.
Oh, no, Dr. Lee said the decedent was cardiac dead, but did not testify as to respiratory.
Well, cardiac, you know, arrest, basically, losing spontaneous, you know.
But no testimony as to respiratory, which is also required.
Yeah, no testimony at all. It's just that stipulation.
Mr. Ishibashi, if you look at the LRB report that Justice Wilson referred to, it talks a lot about concern about the status of the physicians, the potential liability, you know, when should they make the call? And actually, that issue is sort of reflected in the title, Determination of Death. Is there an interpretation of the statute that when it refers to all civil and criminal actions, that it's referring to the liability of the physician as opposed to an intent to make this the exclusive definition for the purpose of the penal code?
Well, I think it talks about, you know, civil and criminal actions in terms of where death is involved. So, you know, I don't know in terms of liability, whether or not they're, you know, physicians are going to be held liable for making the wrong decision or whatever they do. But all I know is that this 327C1 is very particular. And, you know, you could either ignore it or you can uphold it. And I believe that the court should uphold the legislature's determination of this statute because it has to do with death. Otherwise, they're going to go back and mull it over again and again and again, and, you know, it's never ending. And I think they made a good effort in terms of that report that Justice Wilson cites. So
let me just check. Justice Nakayama, did you have a question? I see Justice.
Thank you. Mr. Ishibashi, are you saying then that are you arguing that Dr. Lee's testimony along, suppose 327C-1B did apply in this situation, are you saying that Dr. Chang and Dr. Lee's, they're two doctors who have pronounced death, are you saying that doesn't comply with the statute?
Yes.
Because?
Because they don't, their opinions are not in writing and they don't coincide.
So you're saying that an affidavit is not enough. Does the statute require that the pronouncement be in writing?
Yes.
Where is that?
You look, let's see, the determination of death subsection, is removing by purposes affected by the section, signed statements. It's right there in subsection B, towards the bottom. It says, the opinions of the physicians and osteopathic physicians shall be evidenced by signed statements.
I totally see that, and I can understand that. But why would that be? So the declaration of death isn't valid unless there's a signed statement?
All I'm saying is that it doesn't comport with the statute.
Isn't that, don't you think that's more for bookkeeping to make sure, you know, to make a record? I mean, are they going to stop harvesting this person's organs to save somebody else's if there isn't a signed statement?
No, I don't think they're going to do that.
But I don't think so either.
What I think is that they need to tighten up their procedure here. And, you know, I don't think it's going to stop organ donation or any of that. I think the doctors are too far down that road. So, you know, when you talk to them, I mean, they're excited about that kind of thing. So, you know, I mean, it's just that they need to get some, and maybe the state, the prosecutors can go and meet with these people and instruct them on what's required.
Right. Mr. Ishibashi, we have questions about Justice Wilson, Justice McKenna. We've hit your 30 minutes, but I will give you some additional time for rebuttal. And we'll have these two questions, and then perhaps we can move on to Mr. Kumagai, unless any of my other colleagues have questions. Justice Wilson.
Thank you. Mr. Ishibashi, getting back to the language in subparagraph B, where it says, in the event that artificial means of support preclude a determination that respiratory and circulatory functions have ceased. In that search, is it your view that under those circumstances, it's necessary to follow the procedure to determine whether there is brain death?
Well, I think the rest of the paragraph talks about what is to be done.
All right. So let me ask you then, in this, looking at the facts of this case as to whether or not artificial means of support precluded a determination that respiratory and circulatory functions have ceased, there was a determination of brain death 30 hours before the actual harvesting took place, and 30 hours before there was apparently a determination by another doctor of a cardiac death. So would you give me some idea during this 30 hours while the individual on a respirator and being kept alive from the point of view of being able to harvest the organs? And in that case, wasn't it necessary to resort to a question about whether the decedent was brain dead?
I think that's correct. You know, the person, the family was there. They talked about organ donation, which he had it on his driver's license, basically, and that you know, he was going to donate his organs, and that was clear. That was clear from the start.
Justice McKenna. Oh, you're on mute. Sorry.
Isn't the issue that we're actually addressing here is whether or not there was sufficient evidence of death as required by law? where 327C1C says that the statute does apply to criminal cases. I think it's a leap to say that these signed statements do not exist. The issue is whether or not the state submitted evidence of the signed statements. I'm sure the hospitals are aware of the requirements of the law pertaining to harvesting of organs. So therefore, the issue is, did the state present sufficient evidence, and whether your motion for judgment of acquittal should have been granted based on insufficiency of evidence, which would preclude this issue, the death claim, from being readdressed potentially on remand based on double jeopardy principles. Isn't that the issue we're actually addressing here today? Not that, whether or not that evidence exists. I'm assuming it exists. The issue is, did the state present the evidence?
Well, I don't know what the state has regarding that, or the hospital for that matter. I've had cases where the person, that was a case before this court, Michael Abella, who went in, and the decedent was going through this artificial means of support and everything like that. But there was none of that. There was no evidence of signed statements by the doctors determining what was the actual cause of death. They did testify about it. Well, you died because we pulled the plug, basically. That's it.
All right. At this point, let's move on to Mr. Kumagai. And again, Mr. Ishibashi, I will give you some time for rebuttal, since we had a number of questions for you there at the end. Mr. Kumagai, your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, Judge Toltol, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Chad Kumagai for Respondent Appellee State of Hawaii. Your Honors, in this case, the trial court did not commit error by refusing the petitioner's requested reckless endangering in the second degree instruction. Specifically, because there wasn't a basis in the record, given the facts in this case and the law given to the jury, that the petitioner would be convicted of reckless endangering in the second degree. Because in order to convict the petitioner of that offense, it would have to find the petitioner not guilty of manslaughter, assault in the first degree, and two iterations of assault in the second degree. And given that there's a lack of evidence that the petitioner only placed the decedent in danger of death or serious bodily injury rather than actually causing his death, there was no rational basis to acquit the petitioner of manslaughter and the assault charges. Therefore, under HRS 701-109 subsection 5, the trial court was not required to instruct the jury as to that offense. I would like to point out that this case is distinguishable from Manuel, which was discussed during Mr. Ishibashi's portion of the argument, because in that case, the greater charge had an intentional or knowing state of mind, and the lesser charge had a reckless state of mind. Therefore, based on the facts presented in that case, the jury could have found that the defendant had a lesser state of mind. However, in this case, from the manslaughter offenses, all of the assault charges, down to the reckless endangering the second degree offense, a reckless state of mind applied. This case is also distinguishable from Manuel because the jury would have had to have acquitted the defendant of manslaughter and three assault charges in this case. And because recklessness is incompatible with desire or intention, that's State v. Holbrum, there was no argument that could be made that the petitioner acted with a lesser state of mind in order to acquit the acquit him of the greater offenses or the higher, lesser included offenses. And Your Honor, I think that in previous cases, this court has looked at whether the lesser included offenses had a basis for that charge based on the evidence, based on the elements of the lesser included charge. However, I think the court should interpret the word convict in subsection 5 according to its plain language, which means to prove or officially announce a person is guilty following a criminal trial. And because of that definition, I think the court should take into account all of the instructions that the jury was given, which includes the transitional instructions, if and only if the defendant is found not guilty of the higher, lesser included offenses. Only then would the jury be required to deliberate on lesser included offenses. Yes, Justice Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Kumagai. Let me see if I'm clear about your position. You're suggesting that the jury could not have found reckless as a state of mind as it applied to reckless endangering in the second degree, even though the jury found the state of mind with respect to recklessness as it pertained to manslaughter. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. It is my position that under the facts of this case, the jury could not have acquitted under a reckless state of mind. First, because under a reckless state of mind, a person cannot have an intent for the result of conduct or specific conduct, because recklessness is disregarding a substantial and unjust justifiable risk that the result of the conduct would be such. Further, I think the evidence in this case clearly shows that the petitioner meant to do more than simply put the decedent Jonathan Canoe.
Well, I don't dispute that the evidence could certainly show that the defendant is guilty of manslaughter or, you know, second degree murder for that matter. But in this case, didn't the jury have the option of determining that he wasn't actually the cause of death wasn't a result of the actions of the defendant, but rather the cause of death was the result of the actions of a intervening cause, that he was still alive when the organs were harvested? Wasn't that an option for the jury?
No, Your Honor, not in this case. Dr. Happy testified that the cause of death was the fatal wound to the left side of Jonathan Kanui Flores' head, which perforated his skull and punctured his brain an inch to an inch and a half. Your Honor, if you're referring to the causation instruction that was discussed in Abella, this case is entirely distinguishable from Abella, because in Abella, the decedent could reach towards stimuli, could open his eyes in response to a voice, was becoming more alert. And his
I'm referring to the argument that was made by Mr. Ishibashi during the course of the trial, where he said that while there may have been actions taken by the defendant, including stabbing, that those weren't the actions that actually caused the death, and that a determination could be made that there wasn't, it was reckless, but there wasn't necessarily an intent, and the intent wasn't, and the actions didn't cause the death. I mean, that seemed to have been the argument that was being made by Mr. Ishibashi.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, are you referring to at trial?
Yes.
At trial, the defendant's arguments were that he was at his babysitter, he was babysitting his sister.
Well, not entirely. I mean, if you read the closing argument, right? Or the opening statement, you can see Mr. Ishibashi does address the actions that took place and characterize the actions in a way that would suggest that there wasn't necessarily, for example, there was an argument made not only about recklessness, but also about self-defense. Remember the point he was making when he was talking about the manner in which the altercation took place? And
yes, absolutely, Your Honor. But self-defense would be a complete defense. So if self-defense applied here, there would be no basis to convict petitioner of reckless endangering in the second degree.
Yes, I was focusing on endangering, so reckless endangering second. And I think your position was there's absolutely no evidence upon which a jury could so find. And so I was...
I'm sorry. Well, first of all, I'm sorry for cutting you off, Justice Wilson, but I'm not necessarily saying that there was insufficient evidence to find that the elements of the reckless endangering and second degree offense were not present in the record. I'm saying in order to convict the petitioner of reckless endangering and second degree, the jury would necessarily have to acquit the petitioner of the higher lesser included offenses as well as the charged offense, although admittedly the jury did acquit him of the murder in the second degree charge.
Justice Nakayama. From Justice McKinnon. At the mute.
Mr. Kumagai, it appears that the lesser included issue may also be related to the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence as to whether death occurred pursuant to the statute. I understand it is your position that Chapter 327C1 does not apply to a criminal prosecution, despite the language of subsection D. But if this court were to rule that 327C1 does apply to criminal prosecutions, which appears to be the plain language of the statute, isn't it possible that at least in that situation, you would have to concede that reckless endangering second would be a lesser included of manslaughter in the event you can't meet the definition of death?
Your Honor, I think if that hypothetical were to come to fruition, yes. But I believe that even if the statute were to apply to criminal actions, I think that the requirements of subsection A were met by Dr. Lee's declaration that the decedent was cardiac dead. I understand that the subsection A says respiratory and cardiac.
But doesn't C, Mr. Kumagai, C clearly says that if there's direct organ transplantation, then you have to go under B, right? Unless you have the and the issue then appears to be whether you have the requisite two physicians under B. Now, in terms of your position as to the inapplicability of 327C, your answering brief, and I inquired of Mr. Ishibashi, your answering brief does argue that what do you do when you don't have a body, right? When you can't find a body. However, when I took another careful look at it, subsection D does say that presumptive deaths under the UPC are not affected. So therefore, basically under this statute, isn't it true that the state could pursue a murder charge after a presumptive death after 5 years under the UPC Uniform Probate Code?
It could, but I cannot imagine that the legislature intended for the victims of families who have had a loved one lost due to a homicide wait 5 years in order to charge the defendant for their loved one's death. And I think, I think in order to fully understand this statute, I think that the court should look at the entire context of the statute as it did in State v. Abella while interpreting HRS Chapter 327E. And I think looking at the statute, it is clear that the statute only applies to physicians who determine death. Sections A and B provide a standard for physicians who determine death. Subsection C provides a procedure for physicians to follow when they are determining death. Subsection E provides a review process for standards that physicians use to determine death. It therefore follows that subsection D is applies to those who determine death, not those who cause death. And I think application of this statute would overrule the common law rule that death can be proved circumstantially. And I think a case that...
I'm sorry, Mr. Kumagai, but our common law has been superseded basically by the Uniform Probate Code, right? I mean, the penal code is very clear that there's no crimes unless it's under a statute now. And this statute is called determination of death. How do you get around the plain language of subsection D that all death determination in the state shall be made pursuant to this section and shall apply to all purposes, including but not limited to civil and criminal actions? How do you get around that plain language?
Well, Justice McKenna, as to the common law comment you made, I fully acknowledge that there are no common law crimes in this jurisdiction, but I still believe that the common law principle that death can be proved by circumstantial evidence exists here. And according to Gold Coast Neighborhood Association v. State, 2017 case from this court, statutes which abrogate the common law must do so expressly, not impliedly, and such statutes must be strictly construed. As to the plain language argument regarding subsection D, I think that this court can draw an analogy to its analysis in Abella, where the plain language of HRS 327E, section 13, says that no death that occurs in conjunction with the statute constitutes a homicide. But looking at the entire context of the statute, I think that there's a different story to be told here. And the court can also look at other jurisdictions which have adopted the Uniform Determination of Death Act. Although I do admit that this statute that we have here predates the Uniform Determination of Death Act, I think that the purpose of those statutes are the same as our 327C-1. And under the Uniform Determination of Death Act, there is a prefatory note that says that no physician who determines death under the act shall be held liable for civil liability or criminal sanctions. And I think that's the same type of section that we have under subsection D. So I think the other jurisdictions who have adopted the UDDA are instructed in that manner. Justice Wilson, I see you have a question.
Yes, Mr. Kumagai, I wanted to ask your help with this notion that I think your position that there is no application of 327C1 to a criminal case. And in that regard, the legislative history, including report number 61778, which is a standing committee report to the judiciary that preceded the statute, says traditional standards of determining death recognized by medicine and law are inadequate to meet present medical and legal needs. The current dichotomy between medical and legal standards created confusion in the judiciary and acquiescence in the brain death standard. And then in the materials that we've been talking about, the report to the by the Legislative Reference Bureau, it says there is a present and distinct possibility that a brain dead homicide victim may be maintained artificially for more than a year and a day after the injury. The year and a day rule previously codified in Hawaii was repealed by action which enacted the Hawaii Penal Code. The Penal Code does not, however, specifically prescribe reliance on the year and a day rule. So that, in addition to the specific discussion about the location, the definition of the brain death in the statutes, would suggest that there was careful consideration of the use of the definition of death by a brain death standard. There was careful consideration of it being used in the criminal context. So I have a difficult time suggesting, assuming that 327C1 actually doesn't have to do with, for example, homicides and the definition of brain death.
Well, Your Honor, if the statute was meant to overrule the common law rule that death can be proved circumstantially, I believe that there would be more than a suggestion required in the legislative history to overrule.
Well, there was a great deal of discussion. That's what I'm suggesting. And this specifically refers to brain death and with a focus on the harvesting of organs. So the notion that there would be a very specific definition of death where you have this sort of obscure circumstance where a person has to be kept on a ventilator, which one might, common sense might say means a person's alive, they have to be kept on a ventilator until the time comes to harvest their organs, calls for perhaps a pretty specific definition that will allow for a determination of death that also takes into consideration the need to be sure that the death was not resulting from the actions of the doctor.
Your Honor, if the legislature intended to provide a definition of death for the penal code, it would have and could have referenced that 327C-1 in the penal code.
In a way, did do that when it said no other statutes, no other laws withstanding?
I'm sorry, what are you referring to, Justice?
It says any laws to the contrary notwithstanding when it talks about how it's limited to civil and criminal actions. And there's a preceding discussion in the legislative history about where it should be put in discussions about the penal code. So it seems like there, you could say there has been a demonstration of legislative intent.
Your Honor, if that legislative intent were meant to be enacted, it surely would have been in the statute as the definition, as when the penal code references other sections in the HRS, it does so expressly under the definition section in the penal code itself. That's not present here. And if the legislature had intended that to be, it certainly could have done so. My interpretation of what subsection D actually does is it prevents someone from, a physician, from declaring someone dead pursuant to the statute. And that prevents someone else from later coming and saying, well, that physician caused the death because they later harvested the decedent's organs. That is the, I believe, the true meaning of subsection D.
Very well. Justice McKenna, your question.
Mr. Kumagai. Chapter 707, Offenses Against the Person, has clear definitions of substantial bodily injury, serious bodily injury, but does not define death, correct?
Correct.
And the Penal Code was adopted in 1972.
Correct.
And Chapter 327C was adopted in 1978.
Yes, that's correct.
And the legislative history refers to the penal code and discusses where this statute should be placed.
Your Honor, again, I'm sorry to repeat my arguments, but I don't think that legislative history is sufficient to overrule a common law rule. And I think if the legislature had really intended it to apply in all homicide type offenses, it certainly could have and would have referenced it specifically.
And you don't think that all death determinations shall be made pursuant to this section and shall apply to all purposes, including but not limited to criminal actions, any law to the contrary, notwithstanding, is not clear enough.
It is clear to me that that section applies to physicians who use the statute to determine death. And I think...
So it's up to juries to determine whatever death might mean to them.
Yes, as...
So in other words, a jury could find death even if a person was comatose.
It could, but I think that's what the appellate process is for. At that point, if there was insufficient evidence that the decedent was dead under the common definition of death, then the conviction wouldn't stand on appeal.
Isn't that what we're addressing here? That it appears that the legislature did set out a definition of death and the issue of whether or not it was met by the evidence in this case. And that's all I'm saying, because I would be surprised if the hospitals were not following these requirements. It appears to me the only issue is whether or not there was evidence presented along the lines of the statute in this criminal prosecution.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that presupposes that the statute applies to criminal prosecutions where the person on trial is the one who caused the death. And I don't think that it would apply in this case. So
we're supposed to have like just, you know, one jury could find that a comatose person that had brainstem function that was still breathing on their own, because with brainstem, someone can still breathe on their own. One jury could find that that person has died, but another jury could find that that person has not died.
Yes, because death is given its common meaning pursuant to the penal code, because it is not defined in the penal code. And I think that's not such a stretch to say when whatever term is not defined in the penal code is given its common meaning. And I think that's what's applicable in this case.
Didn't Dr. Happy testify that the cause of death was the action of the defendant? And why isn't that enough to get the case to the jury?
Your Honor, I believe that it is enough to get the case to the jury, because I don't believe that compliance with HRS 327C-1 is applicable in this case, because the petitioner was the one who caused the death of Jonathan Canuy Flores. And you know, finally, Your Honors, I'd like to point out a Nebraska case that I think is particularly on point here, State v. Edwards, 278 Nebraska 55. There, the defendant argued that the death of the decedent needed to be made in accordance with accepted medical standards under the Uniform Definition of Death Act, Determination of Death Act, I'm sorry. The Nebraska Supreme Court rejected that argument, stating that there's nothing in the statute, the language of the statute, to overrule the common law rule that death can be proved circumstantially. And I think that's a similar analysis that this court can and should take with respect to this issue.
Mr. Kumagai, there are cases that go the other way. I mean, I'll cite one, State versus Schaefer, a Kansas case, 574 Pacific 2nd 205, which seems to hold that a statute, although somewhat, the language somewhat different, says the last, I'll just read, analyzing this provision that says the alternative definitions of death are to be utilized for all purposes in the state, including the trials of civil and criminal cases, any laws to the contrary notwithstanding, that was a clear statement that the statute would apply. So there are different views on these issues. Is that not right?
There are, but I think that I think reading the statute as a whole here, especially, is the most critical thing that I'm asking the court to do, to look at the other subsections and hold that they apply to doctors and physicians who determine death, and so should subsection D. So, Your Honors, I see my time is almost up. I thank you for your time. I ask that this court affirm the petitioner's conviction. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Kumagai. Mr. Ishibashi, we'll go. Why don't we aim for about 3 minutes of rebuttal time? And if you need more, I'll certainly consider it, but let's try to aim for that. Oh, you need to unmute. Oh, still muted, Mr. Ishibashi. Sorry, we won't count this time against you.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go. We got you. You have a question from Justice Wilson, but maybe get a quick start, and then we'll hear from Justice Wilson.
All right. Just briefly on this lesser included offense, what the state is arguing is that because the jury didn't decide on the lessers, that therefore the lessers shouldn't be given. Well, the lessers are given before the jury goes and deliberates as options that they have, not after the fact. So I think he's got it a little bit kapakahi there in terms of where it should be looked at. In terms of the statute, it's pretty clear that the statute 327C1 basically, in the statute itself, it just talks about criminal actions. So, it's not a mystery to me, or I think anyone who would read this to include murder, because murder is death. I mean, there's death involved, and it's a criminal action. So it's not rocket science we're dealing with. I think, we're trying to exaggerate the value of this thing, when in fact it is what it is, and the statute is clear.
One question, then I'll turn it over to Justice Wilson. If you look at that LRB report, it spends a lot of time talking about, different doctors having different opinions of what they could or should or ought to do in particular cases. I mean, Mr. Kumagai's argument is that the statute was all about giving clarity to physicians and others in what they can or can't do when they're in this difficult situation of trying to determine whether they can go ahead, for example, with an organ transplant or not. What's your response to that? And then we'll hear from Justice Wilson.
Well, I think the doctors have to decide for themselves what is appropriate in terms of what action they are going to take regarding a person who is seriously injured and in their care. So, I cannot make that decision, obviously. I think it's a case-by-case basis that they discuss those matters with not only themselves, but with the family as well, and that they come to a conclusion as to what is going on with this person, and then live with whatever decision they have to make.
Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. I just wanted to be clear, the relief you're asking for, Mr. Ishibashi, you are anticipating a remand on charges other than the charges that depend on proof of death. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
You're asking for a retrial on the lesser. Is that correct?
Well, if the court wants to just rule on that issue alone, then that's the solution. But I'm asking for the implementation of 327C1, which is a judgment of acquittal argument that was made, which means that the case should just go away.
Well, all right. Well, that doesn't necessarily address those charges for which 327C would not apply.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Just McKenna.
Mr. Ishibashi, has this court not in the past, even if this court has found insufficient evidence as to a greater charge, hasn't this court remanded for further proceedings on lesser included charges?
I'm sure this court has. In the case I mentioned earlier, that case was remanded on a manslaughter charge, and the state agreed to allow Mr. Abella to plead to assault in the first degree. So that's what he did. And, we're awaiting his parole board minimum hearing.
But that case involved a jury instruction. In this case, the argument is there was a failure of proof by the state. Does the state get to go back and retry?
I don't think so. They should have only one chance. They had their opportunity, and they failed.
Justice McKenna, oh, was your question?
Sorry.
No, I believe there's case law and insufficiency. Even if it's insufficient on the greater, there's you can remand on the lessers. But I'm so sorry. I don't have a question. I'm sorry.
All right, Justice Nakayama, your question.
I guess, Mr. Ishibashi, I had the same comment as Justice McKenna. If the court were to find that the statute applies and therefore there was insufficient evidence of death, in, for instance, in Manuel, the jury convicted of an assault. So wouldn't your client still be possibly liable for lessers that did not include the element of death?
Yes. If the court decided to remand this case for trial.
All right. Very well. Any other, anything else to wrap up briefly, Mr. Ishibashi, at this point?
Nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kumagai, Mr. Ishibashi. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.
Ua ho'omalolo ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki e ki e hana hano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.